This podcast may contain content that is graphic and disturbing in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me. Let's fly away.
An Australian man was in London, but wanted to return to Australia. He was broke and couldn't afford a plane ticket. And that's when he concocted a daring plan to ship himself to Australia in a box as air freight. This is Apple for the Teacher, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Anna Thomas. Today's episode is called Cash on Delivery. The man smuggled himself to Australia in a box. What happened?
Starry-eyed, once I get you up there, I'll be holding you.
I want you to think about all the different sports at the Olympic Games and which sports are your favourites. For me, it's the track and field, but there is one track and field event which I don't think gets much attention at the Olympics and not very much airtime on TV. I can't say that I've ever watched a whole competition of this event, and I'm not sure if this is because I'm not interested or it's not really shown on TV that much. And I'm talking about the sport of javelin throwing. So the reason I'm talking about javelin is that the person at the centre of this story was an Australian javelin champion. And you may be wondering how this relates to the content of this podcast. So let's find out. In the year 1960, a man by the name of Reg Spears lived in the Australian city of Adelaide, which coincidentally is where I lived during my childhood, before moving here to Brisbane in Queensland. Reg took up a sport which could be considered as unusual for a young Australian man, and that was the sport of javelin throwing. He went on to compete in the javelin event at the Australian Track and Field Championships in the year 1960, coming in third place. In the following year, he did better, achieving second place. The year after, in 1962, the Commonwealth Games were held in the city of Perth, Australia, and he managed to achieve fifth place. It was while competing in that competition that he met and became friends with a British javelin thrower named John McSorley. They didn't know it, but that meeting was the beginning of a lifelong friendship. After the Commonwealth Games, Reg's next goal was to compete in the 1964 Olympic Games in Tokyo. But first he had to qualify for the Australian team, which unfortunately he wasn't able to due to an arm injury. So he then decided to travel to England in an attempt to qualify for the British team during the English summer. The sports season was over in Australia, but due to the different seasons, he thought he could go to London and train with the British javelin throwers. If his arm got better, he thought he might have a chance. So Reg packed up his belongings, including his javelin equipment, and left his wife and one-year-old daughter behind in Adelaide, but had plans to bring them over to the UK if all turned out well. However, he didn't have the money for a plane ticket, and so he had to find another way to get there. He managed to work his way to England in a freighter, somehow managing to convince the man at the shipping office to allow him on board for free. The man recognised Reg as the champion javelin thrower, and Reg told him that he wanted to go to England to make it big in the athletics world. Reg offered to do any job, washing the deck, cleaning the toilets, etc., to earn his passage to England. And the man ultimately agreed. And the first thing he did when he arrived in London was to pay a visit to his good friend that he had met in Australia, John McSorley, and he told him all about his plans. The national championships were coming up, and with his recent performances, John said he could get him in as a guest. John gave Reg a place to stay and also managed to help him find a job at the London airport in the export freight department with Air France. The two trained together, but his performances were not good enough due to his arm, and his dream of competing in the Olympics was over. So there he was, 22 years of age, in London, contemplating what he should do next. Reg had found that the living conditions in the UK were poor, the climate was so different to Australia, and he ultimately decided that it wasn't a good place to bring up his family. He really missed his friends, and as his daughter's second birthday was coming up, he decided he had to return home, but he was virtually broke and couldn't afford a plane ticket. So the only choice that he had was to keep saving money until he could afford the airfare, although he knew this would take a while due to his low-paying job. But he soon experienced a setback when his wallet was stolen and the little money that he had saved was now all gone. Reg then desperately searched for another way to return home. He tried to get a job with a shipping company as a seaman and therefore earned his way back to Australia, but no one would hire him. He also tried to hitch a ride with the Royal Australian Air Force, but that failed too. Even the Australian consulate wouldn't help him. And that's when another idea came to him while he was working with the freight at the London airport. He saw how large boxes were being shipped by air, and even animals were being sent via freight. And that's when he got a crazy idea to ship himself back to Australia in a box. It was while out one night with John and some other friends that Reg told them about his idea. As they all had been having a few drinks, they just laughed at him, thinking that he had had one drink too many. But Reg insisted he was serious. They tried to convince him that it would be almost suicide to try such a stunt. There was the question about whether the freight section of a plane was even pressurized. And there was also the question about the temperature. Would it be too hot or too cold? And of course, how would he pay the freight charge? It was a lack of money which prevented him from buying a plane ticket in the first place. And who would be the person to send the box? Was he expecting one of his friends to take the box to the airport and therefore implicate themselves in the crime? And what about the person at the other end who received the box? Wouldn't they be in trouble when the box was delivered if he was discovered? But even more crucial, would he even make it alive? But Reg had done his homework and had an answer for all these questions. Firstly, through his work at the airport, he knew the freight section of a plane was pressurized. He also knew the dimensions of the largest box that could be freighted and said this would be big enough for him and a few other possessions that he would need to take. As for the person posting the box, he would come up with a fictitious company who would have reason to ship a box of that size across the world. He would also use a fictitious address in Australia, and most crucial of all, the box would be posted COD, cash on delivery, so there would be no charge to send the box. Reg thought he had the perfect plan and was dead serious to go through with it. John and his friends continued to try to talk him out of it, saying yes, it seemed like a good plan, but the danger was just too great. Not just of getting caught, but they seriously doubted that he could survive such a long trip. But Reg was determined to go through with it. He just needed someone with the skills to build him the correct size box. And it just so happened that John was a carpenter. But John refused to send his friend to almost certain death. However, Reg wore him down until he agreed. John said,
"Okay, you crazy lunatic, I'll build your box, because knowing you, you'll do it anyway. God knows what you'd end up in, some agricultural piece of junk that falls apart before liftoff. You don't stand a chance of pulling this off, unless someone makes you a half-decent, sturdy container. Looks like that idiot is going to be me."
So John set about building the box. He started drawing different box designs and considered all of the features the box would need to have. Firstly, it needed to be no more than 5 feet by 3 feet by 2 feet 6 inches, or 1.5 metres by 1 metre by 75 centimetres. They went to a timber yard and brought all the necessary wood, screws and nails. The box was rectangular in shape and both ends could be opened and closed from the inside. It also had a sign which read, "This side up and fragile." But they also had to cater for the possibility that the box may be handled roughly and even may be turned upside down. So to prevent Reg being tossed around inside, they made 3 straps to tie him in. One strap would go around his torso and the 2 others were arm straps for him to hold onto. Small gaps about the width of a penny were left for ventilation and for Reg to see out of the box. The other matter to consider was in regards to going to the toilet. Reg decided to take 2 plastic bottles, one for water and the other for urinating. And in the days leading up to the departure, he reduced his food and fluid intake to limit the need to go to the toilet. He hoped not to need to have a bowel movement and that one bottle would be sufficient for urinating. Given the small space inside the box, he also had to consider what he was going to take. He took a backpack, which he packed with a torch, a towel, a book to read, 2 tins of spaghetti bolognese, a chocolate bar, a packet of biscuits, and a tube of fruit gums. He also had another bag which contained all the clothing, shoes, and other possessions that he had arrived in London with. And finally, the other important item was his passport. The backpack had all the items he would need during the journey, and he would keep this by his side, while the other bag was secured to the roof of the box, only to be taken down when he arrived. Next, they needed to fill in the freight paperwork. The sender had to be a company shipping to another company in Australia. They decided that the contents would be something to do with shoes, and the receiver in Australia would be called the Supreme Shoe Company. For the sender, they came up with the name the Southern Chemical Company and picked an address from an area in London where various factories were located. They decided that the box contents would consist of plastic emulsion. The receiver would be a fictitious man named Mr. Graham, who would pay the COD. So all was set. When the big day arrived, Reg made sure not to eat any food and had one final toilet break before getting inside the box and strapping himself in. John and some other friends carried the box out of John's place and into the rear of a van. Reg checked the time on his watch, which was 3:17 p.m. John still tried to talk him out of it, but it didn't work. He also reminded Reg to call him as soon as he arrived in Australia so that they could all stop worrying. They arrived at the airport loading bay and carefully offloaded the box onto a trolley and proceeded to the check-in counter. John handed over the forms and was instructed to place the box onto an industrial scale. The paperwork was completed and John was handed a receipt, and that was it. They were free to go. John couldn't believe how quick and easy it had been, although it hadn't been easy on their nerves. They finally relaxed after leaving the building, but still apprehensive of what would become of their friend. So Reg stayed there on the scale for an hour before being taken to the back room where there were other boxes and packages. He was placed into the back of a truck and taken to a warehouse where a forklift placed his box on the top of a stack of other freight. The men then left, locking the large metal door and leaving Reg now in total silence. He knew he shouldn't be there too long, given the time that the flight was supposed to leave. He then got out of the harness and tried to find the most comfortable position to sit in, and he found that he could stretch his legs out if he sat up. The inside of the box was lined with paper to conceal its contents, and he peeled back one corner and looked through the small gap between the timbers. But then he got the urge to pee, which he thought would happen later in the trip, so he just put it down to his nervousness. But he had no choice. He used his flashlight to find the empty bottle and relieved himself, although it wasn't easy trying to find a good position to do so. Then he ate two biscuits, but wished he hadn't, as it then made him thirsty, so he only took a few sips of his drink. As he lay in the box, hour after hour passed, and he wondered what was taking so long. Despite his nerves, he managed to fall asleep, and some time later, he was awoken by the sound of men's voices, so figured it may be time to be loaded onto the plane. So he strapped himself in. Again, he was moved with a forklift and put onto a truck. He heard the men talk about the plane being delayed due to the fog, which now explained why he had been in the warehouse for so long. It was now in the afternoon of the next day. He was finally loaded into the cargo hold of the plane, albeit quite roughly, he thought, considering it had been labelled fragile. But at least they hadn't turned him upside down. The hold was finally closed, and he soon felt the plane starting to move. The time was now 7:48 p.m., and he had been in the box for just over 28 hours. The plane then took off, heading for Paris. He then took the opportunity to get out of the box and stretch. Reg then ate half a can of spaghetti and drank a little, and took a pee, making sure not to spill any. Later he felt that the plane seemed to be descending, and so he secured himself back inside the box. The plane landed in Paris, and again he could hear men loading more cargo. And that's when a frightening thought came to him. He couldn't remember if he had put the wee bottle back inside the box or left it on top of the box. He felt panicked, waiting for the moment when one of the men saw the bottle and then found the stowaway. But to his relief, the hold was again closed and the plane took off. He then felt around the box and was so relieved to find the pee bottle. While in the air, he got out of the box again and needed to pee. The bottle was almost full, and he didn't want to finish drinking the other bottle. But then he remembered he had only eaten half of the spaghetti, so he finished it off and then relieved himself in the can. But then he realized he needed a lid to stop it from spilling. He remembered that he had taken some placemats with him for his mother, which had been wrapped in plastic, and he also had a rubber band. So he tore some plastic and secured it over the top of the can with the rubber band. He ate a few pieces of chocolate and gum and again returned to the box. The plane then landed at the next destination, which was Bombay, India, and the hold was again opened up. His box was picked up by a forklift, which led him to believe that he was being moved to another plane. But the box crashed down with a thud onto the tarmac, and his worst fear was realized. He was now hanging upside down. Light filtered in through the cracks, and he could soon feel the heat of a hot Indian sun. Now Reg was faced with the difficult task of trying to unstrap the harness around his middle and free himself from his hanging upside down position, which took quite a bit of maneuvering. But finally, he released himself and was up the right way again. He checked his watch, and it was now 4:52 London time, so his journey had now been over 37 hours. He then waited there in the hot sun for another hour until the box was moved again. He wasn't strapped in this time, but braced his legs to the side of the box and held on to the hand straps, hoping this would stop him moving around too much and bringing attention to himself. He then felt the box being moved and rotated and was thankful to be up the right way again. The box was again set down, and Reg found himself getting hotter and hotter and starting to sweat, so he felt he had no choice but to remove all of his clothes. Soon he could hear more activity around the box and figured he was going to be moved again. The box was finally loaded into the cargo hold and the plane took off once more. But this leg of the trip proved to be the most difficult due to the turbulence. He figured they must be in the middle of a storm, Reg was being battered around inside the box. Hours later, he felt the familiar feel of the plane going into a descent, and they had landed in Singapore. He hoped this would only be a refueling stop and taking on more freight, and he was right. The plane took off once more. He was now on the final leg, and it couldn't have come soon enough. His whole body ached, and he was totally exhausted. He really was almost at the end of what he could bear. Reg decided to then finish off the rest of the food and drink, giving him now another bottle for pee. He tried to will himself on, that he was almost there, that the claustrophobia was almost over, that he just had to hang on. He felt like he was falling into unconsciousness. But finally, the plane touched down in Perth. His watch told him that he had been on this journey now for 63 hours. But Reg knew it was still far from over. He somehow had to escape from the box and the airport unseen, and once the cargo hold was opened, he heard the most wonderful sound, the voices of men with their distinctive Aussie accents. Yes, he was finally home. The box was again left in a warehouse. The men's voices disappeared and the door was shut closed. This was his chance to escape. His tiredness soon turned to adrenaline as he packed up all his belongings and headed for the door. But now he had a crucial decision to make. Would he try to find his way to the airport perimeter and find a fence low enough that he could climb over? But he figured the chances of being seen would be too great. So the only other option was to head into the terminal. Perhaps he could be lost in a sea of people and escape that way. This seemed to be the less risky option. So off he went, walking casually so as not to bring attention to himself. And he managed to join a group of people who had just departed from a plane and walked in amongst them into the terminal. The passengers had their passports checked and Reg knew this was it. This would be the moment which would determine if all those hours of torture would be rewarded or not. The man looked over his passport and said, "Have a nice day, sir." With his heart pounding, Reg walked out of the terminal as quickly as possible. He didn't have money for a taxi fare, so he would just have to walk. After walking for an hour, he heard the sound of a police siren and quickly ran into a bushy area out of sight. He kept running, brushing past tree branches, refusing to stop or slow down. He never found out if that siren had been for him or just a coincidence. Reg soon came to a clearing and could see a freeway not far ahead. There was also a truck stop, and that's where he headed. He found the toilets and hid inside a cubicle. While panting heavily, he changed clothes, putting on the suit he had taken with him. The washroom was empty, so he took the opportunity to wash his face and take a much-needed drink. Reg then headed into the cafeteria and ordered some food with the only money he had, which was £5. It was while eating that another man with a plate of food was looking for someone to sit and asked if he could sit with Reg. They started up a conversation and Reg told him he was heading over to Adelaide, which was 2,700 kilometres away or 30 hours of driving. The man was a truck driver and offered to take him some of the way, and Reg accepted. He then managed to get other rides until he finally arrived home, greeted by his very surprised wife. Back in London, John was getting increasingly worried about Reg. Day after day passed, and he hadn't heard from him yet. He really thought the worst at the 2-week mark. He didn't know it, but Reg had simply forgotten to contact him. John then contacted a friend he knew, who was a sports reporter for a newspaper in London, and told him all about what Reg had done, and that he was very worried about him. He happened to know someone in Adelaide and gave him a call, telling him the whole story. And that's when the daring escapade of Reg Spears became headline news all over Australia and the UK. Now you will hear from Reg and John themselves. This interview was done 8 years ago in 2015 when they released a book about Reg's story. Here they are talking about what happened and the aftermath of the daring adventure.
We first met in the 62 Commonwealth Games that were held in Perth, Australia, and we immediately got on.
What do you remember about John Reg?
He was, reminded me of myself, you know, blonde bloke, good looking and all the rest of it.
Modest.
We just hit it off. Look, we chase girls. We're very good at that. And
well, we were just out of our teens, you know, both young and...
ready to rock and roll.
And both very accomplished athletes, national champions, record holders at the javelin.
Well, yeah, we were going well. We were going well at that time and showed a lot of early promise.
Mm.
You know, we'd built up a friendship in Australia, and we wrote to each other.
People wrote letters in those days.
And then there's a knock, knock, knock on my door 2 years later, and it's Reg, unannounced. He was over, and fortunately I was able to put him up, and he stayed, about 4 or 5 months. He had a quite unique way of operating, because when he arrived, he had no money or anything, and his way of getting around the place was to stand in the middle of the road with his thumb out, and the car had a choice of either running him down or stopping. With a big, beaming smile, you know, thanks a lot for stopping. Can you just drop us off up the road there?
I got to work that way and got home that way, and I went to some fabulous parties because of it. People would pick me up, and it was on. It was a great time to be in London.
But as you say, Reg, you got injured and you weren't going to get to Tokyo for the Olympics, and you wanted to get home to see you were married by now, you had a little girl.
Wanted to get home
for her birthday.
And there was one catch. I didn't have any money.
Reg, after a little while, got a job, and he was earning some money at the airport. So while he was working there, he was saving up to go home, and then he had his wallet pinched. Everything was turned around then.
So I had to find another way home.
So where did this idea come from to disguise you as air freight?
Oh, I worked for Air France, and I worked in the export cargo section, so I saw animals coming through on aircraft, and it just came to me. I thought, well, wait a minute. Hang on a minute. The biggest piece of freight you could put on an aircraft to go to Australia was, I remember, 5 feet by 3 feet by 2.5 feet. That was the biggest that the plane could take.
So this was stone cold sober. You thought, I know, I'll get in a box and send myself home to Australia.
Why not? And I was in a hurry.
John, what did you think when you heard this idea?
Well, when he first came back with this idea, we thought just it was a regism, you know, he was joking and so on. But there was an intensity about it. And we thought, God, this guy's serious. And I knew Reg, and I thought, he's going to do it regardless. So if he's going to do it, I better make him a box that at least is going to, you know, get him there. The object was actually get everything through and then sell the story and pay for the freight charges.
Was your family in Australia aware of this plan, Reg?
No, I wouldn't. No, they'd worry. You must remember at this time, it never seemed like we were doing anything amazing or remarkable. It was just a couple of bulletproof young fellas think we can pull this off.
Did you give any thought to being discovered or being injured or dying en route?
Well, no. I figured the only thing I could be would be discovered and then, you know, OK, pinched. What do? You're pinched.
We were looking at it that Reg was Australian, so he couldn't be had for illegal entry.
So the big day came, a Saturday. Yeah. In West London. Tell us what happened that day. How did you prepare, Reg?
How do you prepare? You don't prepare. You just get in the box and go.
Did you panic at any point, Reg?
No. I never thought of claustrophobia. I'll take it as it comes. I'll ride it out and see what happens. I've come for the ride. I might be in this bloody box, but it's the same ride as the people upstairs. It was pitch black most of the way. As simple as that, until they got to airports and the cargo hold opened. So all up, I worked it out. It was about 60 hours in the thing.
John, how many days since you'd heard from Reg?
Well, I was beside myself because I thought, I haven't heard from Reg. I haven't heard from him. I really don't, you know, hope nothing's happened to him. So I contacted James Coote, who's a correspondent for a British newspaper, and he knew Reg and he knew me, and I explained the situation to him, and at first he didn't believe me, and then he said, Reg Spears, he said, yes, I do believe you. Leave it with me. I'll contact a correspondent in Sydney, I believe. And he phoned through, and they flew somebody out, and they found that Reg had just arrived home. He'd actually been back.
2 weeks it was, John.
You hadn't called John, Reg?
No. Well, look, you know, you get back home, and I've been away for a while, and before I know it, I stayed with my parents, and all of a sudden, bang, you know, 2 weeks have gone by, and I thought, I've got a telegram. Johnny, he'll know I'm all right. That's what I'm thinking.
Did you make it in time for your daughter's birthday?
Yeah.
Was there a very emotional reunion?
Well, yes, but you see, the thing is, I just turned up. They don't know where I am half the time. So I just turned up. Even though I'm on the other side of the world, don't be surprised if he walks through the door.
And your wife?
Looked happy to see me, of course.
What did she say when you told her how you'd got home?
She didn't believe me. She didn't believe me. But then she thought about it for a moment, thought, well, yes, the silly man has done just that.
Because John had alerted the press, I mean, this was now a big story. There were phone-ins on the radio about it, you know, newspapers descending on, journalists descending on Perth Airport. You make it sound, Reg, as though this was the most normal thing in the world, but clearly the press thought otherwise.
People in Adelaide knew me, but when this happened, I've never seen anything like it, scared the hell out of my mother. Streets blocked with media, and it would go on for weeks, and it was pretty wild.
Did no one come after you and say, you know what, you owe us, much it cost to freight you over?
Oh, yeah, of course they did. Well, you see, the airline was Air India. They contacted me, and I went into their head office in Adelaide, and they said, what are you going to do about these freight charges? I said, well, look, if you sue me, if you make it difficult for me, it won't do your airline any good. And they went with it. So I did well. I heard afterwards, if we'd known what we were doing, we really could have made some money. But there you go. We're just naive 22-year-olds.
I just found it very interesting how they just laughed off the whole incident, which, of course, they were able to because it succeeded. Reg made it out alive. But at the end of the day, they committed a crime. These men are now in their later years, and you'd think that they now would have a different perspective and regret what they had done. But no, there has never been any apology, and I haven't heard in any interview that they regretted what they had done. So it may seem now that we have come to the end of this man's story, but there is more to come. He did some other interesting things later in life, which we will find out in the next episode, part 2 of the story of Reg Spears. Bye for now, and remember to be a good apple.
Oh, babe, come fly with me. Let's fly, let's fly. Pack up, let's fly away. Pack a small bag.